This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. 1964 was a big year for major movements in the United States. Not only was it the year the War on Poverty was declared, but the Civil Rights Act was also signed into law 50 years ago last week. The Civil Rights Act was designed to do away with the prevailing attitude of separate but equal in many parts of the country at the time. While the law's ultimate effectiveness can be debated, it did lay the groundwork for more equality in society. We recently spoke with Dr. Sonny Herford III, a civil rights leader who helped integrate schools in Huntsville, Alabama in 1963 after sending his African-American son to an all-white school. I asked Dr. Herford why he wanted his son to go to that school.
Well, I guess I'll have to go back and tell you about how it was when I went to school. First of all, my home was 6 miles from the school that I attended. And there were school buses. They had city school buses, but blacks could not ride the school buses. So I had to walk to school. The next thing is that my school was located right in the midst of the city dump. It surrounded my school on three sides, like a horseshoe. Matter of fact, I call it the horseshoe phenomenon. We didn't have air conditioning, so we had to have the windows up. So imagine being in the school in early September or late May, and they burning trash out there at the trash pile. I saw in the health book where it said we should get plenty of fresh air.
Which probably was not easy at your school.
Now, I wanted to be a physician.
When did you decide that you wanted to become a physician?
I was about 11 or 12 years old. We had no library in the school, and I was not permitted to use the public library, even though they took our tax money to build the library. We had no gymnasium in the school, no lunchroom, no playground, no chemistry lab, no physics lab, no biology lab. And I thought that would have been worthwhile for a person who wants to be a physician. And so the schools were, as they put it, separate but equal. I thought the only way that we could really have equality was to have the kids to go to the same school. So Brown versus Board had been decided by the Supreme Court in 1954. And my son was born in 57, and now he's getting ready to go to school at 63, and our schools were still segregated, and nobody seemed to make any move to do anything about it. So we found out that the NAACP would assist us in filing the suit. In the fall of 62, we had a desegregation committee in the city, and we went around getting names on a petition from the black citizens asking them to petition the school board to integrate the schools. And we were able to get 35 signatures of 35 families that were interested in having the schools desegregated. And we passed this on to the school board. As a matter of fact, we had several meetings with the school board and expressed our desire to have the schools integrated. But their response was always negative. So then in the spring of 63, we decided to go ahead and file suit.
And was education always one of the main goals, or with that desegregation committee, were you also looking at integrating within different businesses within the community too? And
yes,
bathrooms.
We were going across the board. We wanted to integrate the eating facilities, the hotel and motels. We wanted to have job opportunities. We wanted equal pay. Back in those days, it definitely was not equal pay. Sometimes there were cases where minority people would be working at the same companies where the white people were working, and they were making sometimes twice as much doing the same job. So we wanted to see if we could do something about that. There was a problem about housing. Minorities lived on one side of town, and the other people lived on the other side of town, and the real estate people sometimes would not even show a house to a minority person on certain areas in the city. So we were trying to get across the board desegregation.
And I understand before that moment when your son entered those school doors, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to visit and met with some of you.
Yes, Dr. King came March 19th, 1962, and spoke to us. And we asked Dr. King to come and speak because our movement was losing momentum. And we wanted him to come and see if he could give us a shot in the arm. Sure enough, he did that. And after Dr. King left, our people were energized, and more people joined the movement, and even some Caucasian people joined in with us. Prior to Dr. King's arrival, there were only three or four Caucasian people who were actually participating in our movement.
What were some of the actions that you all would take in order to get your message across or just re-energize the base?
We decided that we should start off low-key. We didn't want to go in with a lot of trumpets blowing and guitars playing and searchlights in the air and all that business, you know. We started off low-key. What happened with our movement, it was the first Wednesday in January 1962, a field agent from CORE, you heard of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality,
okay,
came to Huntsville and went into the high school there. We had one high school for blacks, and came into the University of Alabama A&M, and he enlisted some students to go and sit in with him. So he took these students down to the restaurant, and for instance, if the restaurant tour had 13 stools, he'd take 13, 14 students down there, and they'd each go and sit on a stool. And they were saying, basically, I suspect you're not going to serve me, but you're not going to serve anybody else on this stool on this day. And some of the students would actually sit in a whole day. But then the city found that they had, the city officials, that they had an old law on the books, a vagrancy law, whereby the proprietor could come by and tell the students, adults or whomever, that I don't want you in my business. I want you to leave right now. And it was called trespass after a warning. If you did not leave, then he would call the policeman, and they would come in, and he would sign a warrant, and they would put you in jail. And it was a $100 fine, which is like $1,000 or $1,100 now, and 6 months hard labor. Although I never knew anybody to actually go to the rock pile. But they had to spend 6 months in jail if you did not bail them out. And so we bailed the kids out. And some of them were arrested two and three times in one day. So we had over 600 arrests.
I think I've seen some footage of picketing, in a sense,
yeah,
at least walking up and down the streets with signs.
Well, they couldn't arrest you for picketing. That's First Amendment. If they did arrest you, you know, they couldn't hold you because this is the First Amendment. You can't arrest a person for freedom of speech. So they didn't even attempt to arrest anybody for picketing. And so then our third move, since it appeared that we weren't getting what we wanted with the low-key, we decided to take it a step further, and we decided to have a boycott. We thought this would really get their attention. If you look on the calendar, you'll see that you have three bonanza selling seasons for stores. That's Christmas, Easter, and back to school. And they are approximately 4 months apart. So there's no time in the year that you could start a boycott when you wouldn't be approaching one of these situations, you see. So our movement started in January, and we are coming up to Easter. And back in those days, all of the black people in my community, everybody wanted a suit or a new dress or some new outfit, you know. And they were paying roughly about $100 for these outfits. And we decided, well, this time we're not going to buy that stuff for Easter. We decided we're going to wear blue jeans for Easter, and we're not going to buy them in Huntsville.
And that must have had a huge economic
impact.
That
was money right there. And so we estimate that the merchants lost over $1 million.
Wow. $1 million
in 19. By today's standard, we were talking about 11, 12 million.
Wow.
You see? That got their attention. We had some informal sessions with the mayor and city council, and we also attended the formal meetings. And we had asked them to form a biracial committee of some black people and some white people. And we didn't care how many people were on the committee, and we didn't care what the makeup of the committee was, but just get somebody that looked like they are working to try to solve these problems that we're having here. And so he finally, after the sit-ins and the boycott and all that business, did establish this biracial committee, and they started working and speaking with the merchants. And after the merchants saw that they were losing money, then they decided to go ahead and have what they call a trial integration. So on July 9, 10, and 11, they had a trial integration whereby six lunch counters had agreed to allow the minority people to come in at a certain time, just two initially, only two persons, and get a sandwich or a drink or something like that, you see. And by this time, the city had agreed to cooperate with us, and they even sent some plainclothesmen to these restaurants and these lunch counters. And they would be in the store over at the cosmetic counter, at the magazine rack or whatever, but they'd keeping an eye on the lunch counter, you see. This is when they found out that we were serious. And so it went off without a hitch.
You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Maureen McCollum. My guest today is Dr. Sonny Herford III, a civil rights activist who worked to desegregate the schools in Alabama. So, Dr. Herford, you just talked about the moments leading up and the different efforts that went into integrating and desegregating Huntsville, Alabama. You mentioned that there was a lawsuit that you eventually filed in order to get your son, Sonny the Fourth, into the all-white school that was not only, as you said, maybe a better school, but it was closer to your home, too. After that lawsuit, even that first day of school, you couldn't even get through the doors.
We were supposed to go to the school the day after Labor Day. It was traditional in Huntsville that all the schools, as a matter of fact, in all of the cities in Alabama, the schools would open the day after Labor Day. And so we had won the lawsuit, and the judge had ruled in our favor, and this was the 14th of August of 63. And the school board was supposed to admit these four students who had signed the petition. And then we went on that Tuesday morning, and not only could we not get in the school was locked. There was a mob down there at the school, a crowd of about 250 people, maybe 300. And for a while, I had forgotten how the mob treated us. But then a few years ago, when the black legislators were going up the Capitol steps to vote on the president's health care. Did you see that?
Yes. Was it
That's
similar?
That's exactly the way they treated us. But I had pushed that in the back of my mind, way back in the back recesses of my mind, because I didn't want to think that anybody would hate me that much. And all of a sudden it came back to me. That's the way they treated us that day. So they called us everything that you can think of, my son and me. They did everything except throw rocks at us. But I understand at another school where a lady took her daughter, they did throw rocks at them. So anyway, we couldn't get in. The school was locked. All right, so that was Tuesday after Labor Day. Wednesday morning, we went back. It was basically the same thing. Then Thursday, we went, and the attorneys for the NAACP had told us that they would also be going back to the judge in Birmingham and see if they could get a restraining order. And they were working with the judge in Birmingham. Then Friday, we went, and not only was the mob there, and the school was locked, as previously they wouldn't let the black student in, they wouldn't let the white students in either. There were 12 highway patrol cars, and each car had two highway patrolmen standing beside it, and they were armed and helmeted. And they would not let us even get close to the school. Now, some of the white citizens told me later on that they had some secret meetings with the governor on the weekend. I don't know if that's true or not. But I know that when we went Monday morning, the school was wide open. No mob, no highway patrolman, or anything. And we walked into the school unobstructed at 8:30 Monday morning, September the 9th, 1963, and that was the first time that black kids and white kids had ever been in the same school in the state of Alabama.
And there's a pretty famous photo of you walking Sonny the 4th into school. You're dressed up, ready for work. Mm-hmm. He's just an adorable little boy who I don't know if he even knew what was going on at the time.
He didn't. And when they interview him, he always says he didn't know what was going on. And he said he didn't know he was supposed to be afraid. He said, I didn't know much about people then as I know now. And he said, if I had known, I would have been horrified.
So at that moment when you let go of his hand and then you left him at school and you walked out of the school, what was that like for you? What was going through your
head?
When
I went back leaving him in the school? Mm-hmm. Oh, that was pretty rough. I was getting ready to go to my office to see my morning patients because I usually started about 9 o'clock with my morning patients. And it was pretty rough, you know. Matter of fact, there were a whole lot of things that were rough back in those days. I was just thinking the other day about this situation, and I've never presented this in any of my interviews before. But can you imagine this now, not associated with the school situation, but talking about the sitting in and the people getting arrested at the counters? Okay, now, I'm raising two preschool kids, one daughter and one son. And every day, my wife and I tell them that you shouldn't do bad things. People who do bad things have to go to jail. And jail is a terrible place to be. Well, my wife was sitting in at the lunch counter, and she was arrested.
And while she was pregnant, I believe I read that.
She was expecting. Then how do you think I could handle this to wake up the next morning and tell my two kids, I have to prepare your breakfast today. Your mother's not here. She's in jail. And all the time we've been telling them that bad people go to jail.
Thank goodness. Wow.
It's hard to explain that to preschool kids.
Right.
Yeah.
What was the rest of the school year like for Sonny the 4th?
The very first year, he had a few problems.
With other students or maybe with parents?
From the students. I don't think he had any problem with the parents after that first day. Now, the first day or so, when we were outside and we couldn't get in and those other parents couldn't get in too. And I think they were just as mad that they couldn't get in as they were thinking that we wanted to get in, you see. But then after the kids did get in and they were together, as far as I know, I don't think he had any problem with any of the parents. He did speak of a situation where there was a little girl that they were in the line to get lunch, and there was some trays, and the little girl, as they went down the rail to get to the trays, she couldn't get her tray. She was too short. And so he reached up and got the tray for her, and he went to hand it to her. And he said, she looked me right in the eye, and she said, no, no, my mama told me never take anything from a nigger. And he said, I knew at that time that she didn't really know what she was saying, that that was her mother speaking through her, you know. And so he forgave her for that because he felt that she was just saying what her mother had told her to say. Then there was another incident where he and a fella, another Caucasian boy, were on the playground, and the boy kept calling him names, and he just ignored him until the guy started throwing dirt on him. And so when he started throwing dirt on him, then they tangled up, and they went to the ground, and they threw dirt on each other. And somebody separated them, took them to the principal's office. And the principal looked on the little white boy and looked on him. And he chastised my son because the white boy had more dirt on him than my son did. He laughs about that nowadays. Yeah. But other than that, I don't think he had any problems. Now, this was a public school. And then when he was in the third grade, he transferred to a Catholic school because his mother's Catholic, and he always wanted to go to Catholic school, and he wanted to go to Notre Dame. And so,
which he ended up doing.
Which he ended up doing. And then in the public school, they liked him so much until he ended up being the president of the Student Government Association.
So when you look at everything that's happened over the last 50 years, I'm sure there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I know there's still a lot of
work that needs to be done.
What more can be done? What more do you want people to think about when it comes to civil rights and education and race relations?
We need to try to see if we can get better teachers than we have, or get the teachers to improve themselves by going back taking postgraduate courses. Then we have a tremendous drug problem in the school. We have a gangs problem in the school. And so we need to do more work in that regard.
Dr. Sonny Herford III helped integrate all-white schools in Huntsville, Alabama. He shared his civil rights era story during a recent visit to La Crosse. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. And if you'd like to share comments about Newsmakers or make a suggestion for a future show, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. For updates on future shows, photos, and links to our archives, like us on Facebook at WPR Newsmakers.